ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, beloved listeners, and welcome to LNL, coming to you from Gadigal country. To mark Anzac Day, two stories that reflect on the loss and sacrifice made by the generation who endured the first of the two great world wars. Later in the program, historian Professor Melanie Oppenheimer considers Anzac Day and the contributions made by women. She urges us to look beyond the trenches and the frontline fighting that dominates so much of the Anzac story. There were, she points out, some 4,000 Australian women who bravely served as nurses in World War I. What was their role? What are their stories? That's Women and Anzac Day a little later. But we begin with the biographies of three young Australian men who served in World War I and lost their lives. Life So Full of Promise is the title of Ross McMullen's most recent book. It's a story of accomplishment and bravery, but also one of profound loss, not only for family, friends and community, but as Ross points out, the enormous potential and promise that would never be realised in this country. Now, Ross is an historian, biographer and writer. His previous World War biographies, Farewell, Dear People, won the prestigious 2013 Prime Minister's Prize for Australian History. Life So Full of Promise, further biographies of Australia's lost generation, is published by Scribe. Ross, thanks for joining me.
Good evening, Philip. Thank you very much.
Your first work on this subject, Farewell, Dear People, featured the lives and stories of 10 members of the First World War's Lost Generation. In your latest work, you add another three biographies, with 60,000 Australians dead between 1914 and 1918. How did you select and choose these three individuals?
Yes, well, Australian perceptions of the human cost of the war have tended to focus on the collective impact of all the losses, you know, the numbing numbers, the 60,000 dead and all the maimed, and a focus of that kind is perfectly understandable, consistent with our democratic and egalitarian traditions. But my Lost Generation multi-biographies adopt a different approach, and they highlight the reality that the losses included individuals of extraordinary potential, and that it was a matter not only of quantity but also of very much a matter of quality. Now, how did I go about choosing them? Well, I've got a model in my head all the time, and it tends to have three strands to it. The first one is that the potential character has to have displayed spectacular pre-war potential in something or other, doesn't matter what it is, and then by definition they don't survive the war, and also they are a national level loss because they had such rich potential that was never fulfilled. And I guess the other component is that there has to be a way for me to tell a story in there somehow or other as well.
Now, as an historian and researcher, you have the privilege of reading and holding the primary documents, the private letters, the personal diaries, the family photos, and, artefacts. Is it moving and emotional to be that close to your subjects?
Yes, it very much can be. And in this particular book, there was a stark example of that when I managed to come across a black tin box that had been kept in a family and not much looked at for 100 years. And this was the richest private treasure trove I've ever encountered in more than four decades as a biographer. So that being able to look at that was entrancing, really, and powerful, moving, yeah.
Ross, the news of mounting casualties hit Australian families hard, but as you point out, the effect reverberates throughout the 20s, 30s, and even beyond.
Yes, it does, and this is not only at the individual family level, but I think collectively, from a national perspective, sort of knocks the heart out of Australia, the war.
At the end of our conversation, I'm going to bring up the name of Robert Menzies, because you suggest that it even made his long political reign possible and even perhaps inevitable. Now, let's now consider the loss in more detail. We'll talk about each of them, the three individuals. Let's start with Brian Pockley. He was, I understand, one of the very first Australians to die in World War One. But before we get into the circumstances of his death, tell us about his family and himself.
Yes, well, he emerged from a very privileged family. His father, Frank, was a doctor. They lived at the Upper North Shore at Wurunga. He attended Shore School. He was outstanding both scholastically and at sport. And he had this remarkable temperament, Philip, as well, that everyone revered. He was a high achiever without being driven. He got on with everyone. And his headmaster at Shaw said that he more than any other schoolboy he'd ever known, Brian was my ideal schoolboy.
You note that at the outbreak of hostilities when Austria declares war on Serbia, half the British cabinet remained neutral, not wanting to see the conflict break out in Western Europe. Yet you say the war was underreported in the press in Australia.
Yes, the machinations of the British cabinet, I think, were not highlighted in the press as much as they might have been. And there was this expectation of momentum moving towards war, which Brian Pockley, among others, took on board. But it wasn't as clear cut as you might have assumed if you'd just been reading Australian newspapers at the time.
Why was Brian Pockley, 24 years old, so keen to enlist in the medical corps?
Yes, well, he'd graduated as a doctor by then and, honours degree in medicine at Sydney Uni. His family background, that was very much a factor in his enlistment, reinforced by the values he inculcated at Shaw School. And I think also there was a sense that for quite a few Australians of his generation, particularly in 1914, as distinct from later on, there was a perception that Australians could aspire validly to make a mark on the international stage. And while beating England in test cricket matches was all very well, the best way to do that, most of them concluded, was to achieve something in a war.
Now, we should point out that at the time, most people thought it would be a quick conflict.
That's very true. And that was widely perceived to be the case, and that contributed to Brian being so keen to get involved.
So young Brian Pockley boards a troop ship and finds himself on an expedition to New Guinea. What was the mission, and what happened when they arrived in enemy territory?
Well, this is an intriguing aspect because everyone knows about, or everyone listening to this program for sure will know about the AIF, and this was an earlier force called the ANMEF that was sent up north as soon as possible on an expedition to New Guinea to deal with German wireless stations that they thought might well be there. And the senior commanders in this of this force complacently decided that when they sent a batch of their men ashore on the 11th of September 1914, so this is 7 months before Gallipoli, very early in the war, that only a token force was necessary to deal with whatever enemy resistance there might be there.
A bad decision. The Germans opened fire. 6 dead, 4 wounded.
Yes, that's correct. And a skirmish broke out in what was essentially a jungle. And Brian Pockley was up ahead with the advancing Australians. A German soldier was captured. He had a damaged hand that was bleeding, Pockley thought, dangerously, threatening his life. And so Brian decided that it was appropriate, and he did proceed to amputate this chap's hand without an anaesthetic. Brian heard that an Australian had been wounded. He went back to look for this chap, found him, confirmed that the bloke was fatally wounded. This chap was Billy Williams, and did what he could for him. And then Brian Pockley headed off back towards the front where the fighting was, and he was shot on his way back to the fighting and fatally wounded himself.
How did the public react when the news broke?
I go so far as to say that Brian Pockley was the most intensely mourned Australian of the whole war, which may sound a ridiculous statement, but I'm sure it's correct. And the reason for that is, number one, it's so early in the war, before we've had years and years of heavy casualties that have transformed perceptions, but also because of his own special qualities, which were widely known, and in particular because of the circumstances, in that the previous chap he had tended, Billy Williams, he'd arranged for him to be carried back to the ships, and he gave away, to enable the carrying back to be safe, his, i.e. Brian's, own protective brassard, the medical badge that signified that he was a doctor and a non-combatant.
So that in effect led to his death.
It did. That led to his death. And when this became known back in Australia, on top of his personal qualities, acclaimed, renowned personal qualities, the reaction was intense, when there were profiles and obituaries throughout the nation.
And, of course, the very earliest victim of war.
He was one of the very earliest Australian casualties, and well, there's been to-ing and fro-ing. His father thought he was the first Australian to die. The reality is that he was the first Australian officer to die in an Australian uniform.
But things get even worse for the Pockley family, don't they?
Yes. Brian had an admired brother, younger brother, Jack Pockley. And years later in the war, Jack Pockley was an officer in the 33rd Australian Battalion, and his unit was rushed to the rescue in the climax of the war, and he died in the process there. A British general directed that the 33rd Battalion should counterattack at a particular point where the British could not hold the Germans, with the Germans attacking, and the 33rd Battalion went forward accordingly. Jack Pockley was hit, and there were selfless circumstances here too, in that people rushed to aid Jack Pockley, and he said, no, leave me, go and tend to that sergeant first, that wounded bloke over there. And they looked after the wounded sergeant, came back to Jack, and by then he had died.
Ellie Nell on RN, and my guest for this Anzac Day special is historian Ross McMullen, author of Life So Full of Promise, Biographies of Australia's Lost Generation. Introduce us now to Norman Callaway.
Well, Norman Callaway was a working class boy from the Riverina who grew up at Hay, and his family moved to Sydney in 1912 because Norman had displayed spectacular promise as a cricketer. He was a very talented batsman, and his feats in Sydney very soon established him with the reputation of someone who was widely seen as a future Test champion. He played one first-class innings only and made 207 going in when his team was in trouble. So he had spectacular talent as well.
I know very little about cricket, but even I know that's quite spectacular. And like many promising and all successful athletes, the public expected a lot of them. They were under additional pressure to enlist.
Indeed they were, and this was particularly the case in relation to Norman and cricketers. There was a lot of explicit and implicit pressure to enlist, and in fact the New South Wales Cricket Association cancelled first-class cricket and insisted that cricketers should be in khaki.
He serves in the same battalion as Arthur Stace. And we've got to talk about Arthur because, of course, he became the that eccentric gentleman who chalked the word eternity on the footpaths of Sydney. I remember seeing it writ large once on the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Did you? Yes. Well, that he had a lot in common with Norman. They overlapped quite a bit in the 19th Battalion, and his war, he survived the war, Arthur Stace, but his experiences clearly had a tremendous impact on him, and that was his way of coping with them.
We'd probably talk about PTSD these days, wouldn't we?
We would. We would.
Okay, so like so many other young Australians, he dies in a hail of gunfire, but he's not officially reported dead.
He was in the category of missing. That's a terrible situation, obviously, for parents and loved ones, where they sense that the chances of their loved one surviving must be slim if the military authorities can't find out where he is or what's happened to him. But nevertheless, they find themselves clinging to this desperate hope that he might just be one of those exceptions who's turned up in some remote hospital or something and hasn't been found.
Now, his family responds to the news not only with sadness but with bitterness, and they become anti-war.
Very much so. Yeah, that's my understanding. I both his parents and his sister Jessie lived till at least their late 80s, and none of them ever gave any sense that their impression was that he had listed from motives of king and country and that kind of thing, and they felt that he'd been pressured to enlist.
Now, unlike Brian Pockley, who had, streets named after him and his name on a plaque in public places and features in stained glass windows, there's not so much to commemorate Norman, is there?
No, there isn't. I think he should be better remembered. I'm not sure how. There's lots of potential ways you could think about doing that, but he should be remembered better than he is, for sure.
Is that a bit of class consciousness?
I think it largely is, yeah. There's a lot of that involved, yes. There's all sorts of cricket-related memorials that could be instituted to remember him, and they haven't been yet. There is one exception, and that's a cricket commemoration in the Riverina to him, but I think there's certainly scope for more, Philip.
Well, you've filled that role by writing about him in your book.
I hope I've retrieved him in a way that enables more people to know about him, yes.
Now, let's turn to the third person in your life full of promises. Introduce us to Murdoch Mackay and his family.
Murdoch Mackay's grandfather was Angus Mackay, who was a significant politician in Victoria. He was the Minister for Education and Mines.
But he came from a media background, didn't he?
He did. He before he went into the state parliament in Victoria, he acquired the Bendigo Advertiser newspaper, and it became renowned as a regional paper in Victoria under his leadership, and then his son, as Angus, the MP, had always intended, his son George Mackay, took over the editorship, and he was an outstanding Bendigo citizen, George Mackay, and the Bendigo Advertiser flourished for decades under his leadership. And so Murdoch, who's the grandson of Angus and the son of George, he emerges from a significant Bendigo family. He's a precocious student with prodigious talent and achievements. He completed an outstanding law degree at Melbourne University and won the Supreme Court Judge's Prize for finishing top in final year law. And at that stage, he had just turned 20, and the law professor, who'd been there just about two decades, said that he was unaware of any more able student in his time than Doc Mackay.
Can you explain what the Wheat case was about? Because this fella appears at the High Court.
Yes, well, that's one of the most notable legal cases in Australian legal history, the Wheat case, where there was a High Court case involving a complicated constitutional matter, and the principles decided in the court case related to Section 92, which was a long-standing, over many, many decades, difficult wording in the Constitution that caused lots of trouble and lots of court cases. And the Wheat case was seen as an important one along that process. And Doc Mackay, after he'd only been at the bar a couple of years, and he was briefed to appear in that. So he was a spectacular talent in a number of ways.
That question was a bit of a Dorothy Dixer, because we actually did a program a couple of years ago on the Wheat case, and yes, you're perfectly right, it was of immense significance. Now, like so many young blokes of his time, he simply had to go to war.
He believed in the cause. He was very much in love with his girlfriend, Margot Watson. He had been in love with her for 4 years and was still waiting for her to commit Philip. And she had frustrated him by not doing so. But what he said about the war to her was that as a fit and trained militia officer who accepted the validity of the cause, he had to go or his self-respect would never recover. But that in no way implied any diminution of his affections for her. And she accepted this. And the prospect of his imminent departure seemed to galvanise things for her, and they became engaged in 1915. And then just a few days before he left, they very, very suddenly decided to get married.
And she has no idea that she'll so soon be a widow. And he's on a ship headed for Gallipoli. What did he find when he arrived there?
Doc is an officer in the 22nd Battalion, and he's an outstanding officer, brave and inspiring and insightful. He's also, Philip, the battalion's champion letter writer, renowned for these very long love letters that he's sending home to Margot.
But he's censoring those letters, isn't he? He arrives in the front lines, the stench of death, the conditions are appalling, but he doesn't need official censorship to report things differently.
That's absolutely right. He was extremely motivated to avoid his wife and his own family, the Mackays back in Bendigo, being more anxious about his fate than they already were.
And he writes that things are quiet and monotonous.
Correct, yeah, and very much at times when they're not, he keeps saying that.
Now, he's part of the successful evacuation from Gallipoli and serves briefly in Egypt, then it's off to the Western Front. What's it like for Doc when he arrives in France?
Well, they have various frontline operations that, of course, I outline in the book, and they take their turn in the front line and experience very heavy bombardments and other difficulties of that kind. But it's when they are transferred to Pozières, transferred to the Somme, where things liven up particularly for the 22nd Battalion. So this is the British attack on the 1st of July 1916. It doesn't go overly well, and the Australians, or a lot of the Australian units, are sent to the Somme sector to reinforce.
We should talk about the huge losses. His 22nd Battalion, it was reduced by 2/3 in 10 days.
It was extraordinary. Yeah, this is all about Pozières, Philip. What happens there? There are over 600 casualties in the battalion in a few days, essentially. Yeah, there's two battles of Pozières that they're involved in. The first one, late July, is a failure overall, though happens to be a success on the left where Doc Mackay was himself and the 22nd. But then they do the whole battle all over again, and it's a very big one. And Charles Bean, Australia's outstanding official historian of World War One, goes so far as to say that when their second attempt at the Battle of Pozières that the 22nd Battalion were in, and many other units as well, that becomes Australia's most outstanding success, this battle, for the whole Somme campaign that involves lots of battles, because, says Charles Bean, of what Doc Mackay did in it. He is that crucial that his leadership enables this victory to happen. And, of course, tackling a biography of Doc Mackay, I've got to look into this myself, and I did, and I agree with Bean. What he did was extraordinary.
News has cabled back to Australia of his death, and his wife and family are informed, but this is unutterably poignant. His letters continue to arrive after his death.
They do. So I should point out that he died in the process of that, of displaying that outstanding battle-winning leadership. So he died in the act of doing that. And then, as you say, Philip, letters keep coming back. There's this delay. We're used to, you know, instant communications, of course, these days. But back in World War One, of course, things were very different. One in particular was this farewell love letter to his wife, Margot, that he wrote and gave to a friend and asked him to send it to her in the event of his death. That's the one that really gets to you when you talk about emotional letters.
It's heartbreaking just to hear you tell that story. Let's now conclude where I began, by your proposition that the death of Mackay and the others helped create a situation of such loss of potential for Australia that it may have facilitated the almost endless rule of Robert Menzies.
Well, I do touch on that near the end of the book, Philip, and this is partly because, you know, I think Doc Mackay is a classic example of Australia's lost generation, exceptionally intelligent, an outstanding leader, inspirationally brave, and a talented advocate, all those things that we've talked about. And he was a potential prime minister, those who knew him best felt. They felt he was capable of it, and he had all the attributes, certainly. Now, interestingly, the winner of the Supreme Court prize 6 years after Doc Mackay was, as you've pointed to, Robert Menzies. He emerged, he had lots in common with Doc besides the Supreme Court prize, emerged from regional Victoria, affiliated with Ormond College, tall and fit, enjoyed soldiering in the militia, and advocated the need for conscription during the war. But he did not enlist, and this is, you know, this has often been said, Philip, due to his family circumstances, the two other brothers had enlisted and his father wasn't well. But this, of course, became controversial after he entered Parliament, and especially so when he aspired to lead Australia with another world war looming. Now, you'll remember that well-known comment by Eddie Ward and others that, you know, Menzies had this outstanding potential military career until war broke out.
Ross, we've got to wind it up. But look, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on your latest book, Life So Full of Promise. Further biographies of Australia's lost generation, published by Scribe. And coming up, we're now going to talk to Melanie Oppenheimer, who wants to remind us of the contributions that women made in that great war of 1914. As you know, beloved listeners, the tradition of Anzac is almost always gendered male and white. But what about women? They didn't merely watch and wait for their men to come home, but were actively serving, not as combatants, but at the front line, nurses and auxiliary workers. And how well do we commemorate their service? My guest is Professor Melanie Oppenheimer. Melanie is Honorary Professor, School of History at the ANU, Emeritus Professor at Flinders, and a recent President, past President, of the Australian Historical Association. Melanie, welcome. Given the numbers of women who served are significant lower, I suppose it's inevitable that men are in the forefront of commemoration.
Hello, Philip. Yes, you're absolutely right. In terms of raw numbers and because of the preclusions that women had upon them for most of the 20th century, if you're just going to talk about battles and trenches and things like that, then of course, yes, men dominate. But I've always argued that I think we need to think about war, war commemoration, the Anzac mythology, the Anzac legend, if you will, in a broader light. I think we need to be much more inclusive and pull the lens back. Because if you do that, you will see the roles that women played are not insignificant.
Well, let's you and I do some lens pulling together. But before we do, we should also point out that when I talked about the Anzac tradition being gendered male and white, I guess the same thing can apply to Indigenous soldiers.
Well, that's absolutely right. The Indigenous soldiers have been, we don't know as much about that because they didn't note that on their enlistment. But there's been a lot of work done now on Indigenous representation in the military, and it's quite extensive. And also with women as well. There are Indigenous women that pop up in the story, but it is, I guess, largely due to Australian society, the makeup of Australian society through the 20th century, it is largely white.
My old friend and erstwhile editor, the late Les Carline, wrote one of the principal texts on the Great War. Did he widen the lens to include women?
I'm sorry to say, and I don't want to take anyone, you know, I don't want to sort of, you know, cause a debate so early in our interview, but I believe that Les Carline in his, I think you're referring to The Great War, his 2006 very extensive study that won the Prime Minister's History Prize, and it was really seen as the definitive book on World War One. He excluded women, simply weren't part of his narrative. And I actually, we had a discussion on Saturday Extra once with Geraldine Doog about that, and he kind of took exception to what I was saying, and he just said, look, I just followed the sources, you know, and I went where the sources took me. And I just said to him, well, you know, we really need to take the blinkers off, you know, broaden the lens, pull back, get out of the trenches. And if you do that, you will see where women participated and the roles that they played. And unfortunately, in that otherwise, you know, excellent volume, he didn't do that. And he barely mentioned nurses and didn't really talk about women in any sense at all.
Melanie, what are the numbers of women who served in World War One and World War Two?
Well, the official figures from A.G. Butler, who was the official war historian for the medical volume, he estimates that 2,139-odd Australian Army Nursing Service nurses embarked from Australia, and a further 129 were seconded to the British. But the figure is much, much higher. I estimate it's probably double that. So that means that women, that's only women who left Australia officially with the army, right? That's how that number is reached. But, you know, there were hundreds of women in Europe and in England at the outbreak of the war in 1914. There were those who trained as nurses and then made their own way because they missed the first intake of Australian Army Nursing Service, the call. And then, you know, the army initially said, oh, we don't need any more nurses, you know. So women who were really desperate to engage and to be a part of it, just like their men friends that were heading off, you know, they made their own way, cobbled together the money to get to the UK. Some worked with private hospitals, with the Red Cross, the French and the British. I mean, the whole thing is, it was World War One, in my opinion, was a free-for-all. And if you had the wherewithal and the guts and the determination to get to the front line, wherever that was, you got there. So we don't count those women in the official statistics. So, you know, they're just not recognised. And so the numbers, I think, are a lot higher. The other problem is that women are hard to track because often when they marry, they change their name, and then they're lost to history, in my opinion. Can't find them.
And 50,000 served in various women's services in World War Two.
Yes, even higher. There's upwards of 60, I think it's something. I mean, this is the thing when you start playing with figures, you know, like they go all, you know, you can find different figures. But I think more than 66,000 or so enlisted in the auxiliary services during World War Two. That's about 2% of eligible women aged between 15 and 60. And so that's in all the sort of the WAC, the WAF, the RANs, the AWARs, those women's auxiliary services. So that's quite a sizable increase from the First World War. But still, those women also had devilish trouble, you know, when they came back or after the war, when the war ended. You know, the RSL said that they, you know, weren't eligible to join the RSL. They couldn't march in Anzac Day. You know, all these sorts of little things that come up through the 20th century that just hinder the progress of women and how we see them and their role in war.
Melanie, would you be kind enough to take us into your attic?
Okay, yes. Do you want me to talk about my grandmother's overalls?
Exactly.
Her glamouralls. Well, thank you. I love talking about my grandmother, Nancy Niverson, who is no longer with us, of course. But this is how my lifetime's work and interest in voluntary work in wartime and women in war began back in the 80s. I don't know, maybe historians have this thing, but I just love to ferret around, you know, in attics or wherever. And I was looking.
You are a notorious ferreter.
And anyway, one day I came across this little suitcase and I opened it up and I found a beautiful pair of blue overalls, neatly folded, and there was a couple of Red Cross VAD uniforms, and there was, you know, a diary, a notebook, a photograph album, letters. Anyway, the blue overalls, I put them on because this is the 80s. I was quite young and, well, in my early 20s, and overalls were a thing then. Anyway, I put them on. They fitted perfectly. So I wore them everywhere. And these overalls were given to my grandmother when she served as part of the Red Cross VADs on HMS Glory. So a British aircraft carrier which sailed around the Pacific at the end of the Second World War between September and December 1945, repatriating people from all the places where people have been moved, you know, soldiers, civilians, ex-prisoners of war. And so she did this for 3 months. And there were two other British aircraft carriers as well that had these medical teams of Australian Red Cross VAD women. And so I wrote about her story. And then after that, I realised that no one had looked at the role of women in these sorts of organisations like the Red Cross. So we're talking about unpaid labour. And so then I went on to do my PhD on patriotic funds or volunteer charities in World War II, which is largely the place where you find women. So other than those 66-odd thousand of women who were in the auxiliary services. And so I wrote my PhD thesis and, went from there.
We're going to circle back to that in a minute. But first of all, I want you to tell me about a book called Oceans of Love.
This is my favourite book that I've written, 6 or 7 books or something. But this book, Oceans of Love, which is how this particular individual nurse signed off her letters to her extensive family. It's about a book about Narelle Hobbs. Now, the thing about Narelle that is really interesting is that she's one of those countless numbers of Australian women who missed the first call for the Australian Army Nursing Service, and then they said, we're full, we don't need you anymore. And she was out at Brewarrina as the matron of the hospital and couldn't just walk out. You know, she had to get, replacement. So by the time she got to Sydney, she'd missed the boat, literally. So her family cobbled together the money because she wanted to serve. She was in her early 30s. She was unmarried. She wanted to do what all her male friends were doing, which was enlisting and going overseas. So she goes to London and enlists in the Queen Alexandra's Imperial Military Nursing Service, the CAMES. And this was her first mistake but she didn't realise it at the time. And people, we didn't. But she enlisted with the British Nursing Service, which she went, first saw her service in Malta, which is when she's nursing Australians and Brits and everyone else from the Gallipoli campaign, which was fine, which was what she wanted to do. But after that point, she ends up going to Sicily, to India, to Mesopotamia, which is Australian troops weren't there. She realised very soon that she was in the wrong service. She didn't like the British. She used to sort of say, thank God I'm an Australian. She got so frustrated with the British medical system and how they treated the women and didn't give them any freedoms. And she realised, she was in the wrong place. But her story shows us a part of war that we never really tend to talk about in the sort of the ANZAC, sort of the Australian story, because it's not about Australian men. Because the men are in the Western Front or in Egypt and Palestine. They're not in the Mesopotamia, for example. And so Narelle gets sick and in the end she actually dies on her way home to Australia. It's a really sad story. But she's not, she's part an example of those women, countless numbers, because we actually have no idea, who, because they didn't leave Australia within the Australian military system, are not recognised and counted.
So has Narelle, or indeed your splendid grandmother, ever been commemorated?
Well, actually, Narelle has, through the British. Her name is on a stained glass window in York Minster in England. She's also in a panel on the Basra War Memorial. Now, I don't know exactly if that Basra War Memorial still exists, having, with all the conflict and that's been happening there in the last 20-odd years. She's also on the honour roll at the Brewarrina Historical Society. And her eldest sister, because she came from a large family of lots of sisters and one brother, renamed her Pymble House Narelle. And the street is named, there's Narelle Avenue on the North Shore. So she's actually done reasonably well. However, she's not in the Australian War Memorial. I mean, her papers and things are, but she's not commemorated there because she didn't leave Australia. And my Australian grandmother, Nancy Niverson, she actually has a little park named after her in little town of Walker, but that's because of her other community work that she did in the town, not because of her Red Cross war service.
This is Ellie Nell, and my guest is Professor Melanie Oppenheimer. Now, let's talk about the Red Cross in Australia, because you've written a book about it. how it was established in the beginning of the 20th century. Why is volunteerism significant in our understanding of women's role in war?
Well, thank you for talking. I know I can bring the Red Cross into any conversation, Philip. It's an all-encompassing organisation, but it is so important for this topic. So the Red Cross is formed in Australia, the Australian branch of the British Red Cross Society, in August 1914, and its founding president is Lady Helen Munro Ferguson. So she's the top of the pile. She's the wife of the Governor General. She's had experience. She's only arrived in Australia a couple of months beforehand, but she's had a lot of experience with the Scottish branch of the British Red Cross Society back in Scotland. So she, as soon as the war's declared, she knows exactly what to do, how to structure the organisation. Now, because of our federated system is so new at this point in time, it's only 13 years old, the federated Australia. She knows the states are very important. So she gives them complete autonomy set up by the wives of the governors of each state. And she calls on Australian womanhood to join the Red Cross. So she sees the Red Cross as this is women's duty in the war. The men will go and enlist and the women will do their voluntary work through the Red Cross or other war charities. That is what they do. And it becomes hugely successful. I mean, not so much now, but say 20, 30 years ago, there wouldn't be an Australian town or hamlet or a suburb that didn't have a Red Cross society. And 90% of those members were women. So it became a really, really important organisation. And basically, so what did they do? They raised money, they were working for the sick and wounded soldier and their dependents. And it really, until the 1970s, that was the main constituency for the Red Cross. And women, this is where women were working. But because it's not, I don't know, it's been pilloried by a lot of historians. The early historians who were writing on war, they just don't think it's important. They laugh at the number of socks knitted, and all this sort of thing. It's like, well, how important is that? Well, actually, the socks are really important because if you don't have dry socks in the trenches, you get trench feet. The army doesn't supply socks. So who's doing that? Who's creating that, those items? It's women through their voluntary war work.
Now, World War II, high point, as more women served than before. But then there's the issue of being demobbed, which goes on, of course, is echoed during or after Korea and Vietnam.
Yes, that's right. So, okay, so the Australian government didn't want women involved in the services in the first place. But, men enlisting, manpower shortages, they need to create these women's auxiliary services. So they do that. But it's always a last resort. So as soon as the war is finished, the women's auxiliaries are demobilised. By 1947, the AWARS, the RANs and the WAF are disbanded. Women are told to go back to your Laminex kitchen table and tell your war stories there, that's where you belong. That's your role. That's your domain. Your domain is not in the military. And in fact, in December 1945, the federal cabinet decided that no service women were to be sent to Japan as part of the British Commonwealth Occupational Force, apart from the nurses. So the nurses was well established. That's a caring domain, female, orientated, fine. The nurses go, but no one else. And interestingly, the army, the military by that stage, are really used to having women in those roles of, drivers or signalers or typists or whatever. And there's a shortage and they need them. But the government is dead set on not having them in the mess hall. They don't like them.
You delivered the Blamey Oration in 2018. What was your theme?
So that was looking at the – it was basically towards the end of the World War One commemorations, which Australia, we really indulged a lot. And, we kind of had a time of reflection through that centenary. Basically what I was looking at and talking about was the role of women in war, how important they are, and also that war, you can't just – look, the thing we talked about at the beginning, you can't just look at what's happening in the trenches. It's war and its impact, the huge ripple effect. And it's about particularly now, I mean, the nature of warfare is changing so much and so rapidly through the 20th and 21st centuries. There's no front line. You know, where is the front line? So war is about people. It's about women, children, communities, the whole scale destruction of, or potential destruction of humanity. And so I think the concept of war has changed over the 20th century. How we view these conflicts needs to change to reflect broader society, and then also about thinking more broadly about war and its impact.
In 2021, only 20% of the ADF were women. That's pretty low. Do women not want to serve?
It is quite low, isn't it? I think they were hoping there was a woman in the ADF report 2015-16, which actually hoped to have about 25% of women in the ADF by 2023 or something. They haven't reached that. It is about 20%.
What they have got themselves is a reputation for sexual assault and misogyny. Yes.
Well, exactly. Who would want to join? You'd have to really, you know, you'd have to really think carefully, I think, about it. I mean, women can now serve in all areas, even including the SAS if they meet the bar. But that's only, you know, since full integration has only occurred in the last 10 years. I mean, it's only since the mid-1980s and the Sex Discrimination Act. So the idea that things that happen in ordinary society do impact on the military, it takes time for these things to work itself through. But, yeah, I mean, you'd have to ask yourself the question, why would you actually want to do that? But I think the military at the moment, as I understand it, actually has a problem with both men and women wanting to join the services. They need a complete rebrand or something. I mean, you can see that in the advertisements sometimes on TV. They're sort of pushing women to the front of the advertisements, saying, you know, you want to do this in your army. But I just think that it's, you'd have to think twice before putting up your hand. Even though now, technically, women are completely equal and can serve in any position in the military.
Before you are dismissed and are able to march from the parade ground of the Little Wireless Program, $500 million is being spent on remodelling the War Museum. What should be done to honour women?
Well, it's a very this has been very controversial, hasn't it, Philip? I mean, I'm not privy to the details, but I think we need to remember that it's the Australian
War. That's
because
you're a woman.
Yeah, well, that's right. Except, do you know that when I embarked on my foray into this topic, the War Memorial was the place where I actually attended my first academic conference. Back in the 80s and 90s, they used to host these sorts of academic conferences. So, you know, they seem to be more accessible and open back in the 80s and 90s than they are today. So that's sort of a question. I think it needs to be open. I think it needs to, if you were spending all that money, it needs to be representative of all Australian society. And as Australian society changes, as war changes, we need to ensure that the Australian War Memorial remains relevant and true to the Australia that it represents today and then into the future.
Let us salute the flag and salute our guest, Professor Melanie Oppenheimer. Melanie is Honorary Professor, School of History at the Australian National University. Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you, Philip.
And that's your lot. Thanks for a great week to E.P. Anna Whitfield, producers Catherine Zengra, Taryn Priedko, Ian Coombe, Chloe Adams, and Amanda Roberts. See you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.